It's 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov Thursday said the Syrian government has stopped all active military operations in Aleppo. The pause in military activity would allow a humanitarian evacuation of civilians. Reaction in Washington was to wait and see what is actually happening in the city. Lavrov says a meeting has been scheduled Saturday in Geneva between U.S. and Russian military experts. They'll discuss the situation in Aleppo. United Nations Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, spoke to reporters.
There are moments when there is an awareness that military victories are not a victory for peace, because peace needs to be won separately. And there are moments when, in fact, everyone realizes that perhaps now is the time to start again looking at the political process.
Earlier Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said he was hopeful about a potential ceasefire agreement with Russia to end the fighting in Aleppo. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, though, says regardless of what happens in Aleppo, his troops will continue to fight until the conflict is over. South Korean lawmakers have introduced a motion to impeach President Park Geun-hye over a multi-million-dollar corruption scandal. The motion was introduced Thursday during a session of parliament. Lawmakers will probably take a formal vote Friday. Rescue workers in Indonesia searched Thursday for people who still might be trapped in rubble caused by an earthquake that struck Aceh province. The magnitude 6.5 quake has killed about 100 people and injured more than 100. A quake hit off the coast of the Solomon Islands early Friday. There were reports of collapsed buildings on the island of Malaita, and there was another earthquake off the coast of Northern California. This is VOA News. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has picked a global warming skeptic and staunch ally of the fossil fuel industry to head the country's Environmental Protection Agency. Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt has been a key critic of President Barack Obama's plan to fight climate change by cutting carbon emissions from the nation's power plants. Environmentalists were quick to denounce Pruitt's nomination. Here is Melanie Benish, an attorney with the Environmental Working Group.
Regardless of who you voted for, no one voted for dirty air and no one voted for dirty water. But if Pruitt is our EPA head, that may be what we get.
However, Trump emphasized that he wants the EPA to focus on keeping the nation's air and water clean. Media reports say Trump has picked restaurant executive Andrew Pusder, a critic of minimum wage boosts and other worker protections, to head the Labor Department. Trump visited Columbus, Ohio Thursday and met with survivors of an attack on college students last week by a Somali immigrant.
And we just saw the victims and the families, and we were these were really brave people, amazing people. The police and first responders were incredible.
The president-elect then traveled to Des Moines, Iowa, for another thank-you rally. John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth, has died at the age of 95. The former astronaut and U.S. senator had been hospitalized recently in Columbus, Ohio. Glenn was the last surviving member of the original Mercury 7 team of American astronauts. A Japanese ship has recovered the body of a missing Marine pilot whose jet fighter crashed off the coast of Japan. A military spokesman says Captain Jake Frederick was from Texas and based in North Carolina. The main challenger in Ghana's presidential election has said he is confident of victory, but he is calling on his supporters to give the nation's electoral commission more time to do its work. Nana Akufo-Addo spoke to supporters in Accra on Thursday. The commission is slowly releasing provisional results from Wednesday's presidential and primary elections via Twitter. An anti-corruption group says Afghans paid an estimated $3 billion in bribes in the past year, registering an almost 50% increase since 2014. The findings are part of a biennial corruption survey released Thursday by Integrity Watch Afghanistan. According to the survey, respondents who dealt with the courts reported they were asked for bribes 55% of the time. Results were not much better when they dealt with prosecutors or municipal governments. Taking a brief look at markets, major U.S. stock indexes closed at all-time highs for a second day in a row Thursday, led by gains in banks. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington, and today is Friday the 9th of December. And here are some of the stories we're covering for you. Ghanaians are eagerly awaiting for official results in the just-concluded presidential elections. The Electoral Commission held a press conference in which they say that they will only be releasing results when it receives physical documents from the field.
The Electoral Commission of Chairperson also said that it appears that this electronic system has been compromised, so they decided to go manual, and that is part of the reasons why things have delayed, coupled with the postponement of the election in Jama North District.
VOA's Peter Cloti in Accra, Ghana. And human rights activists are concerned that Senegal's newly approved penal code defines terrorism too broadly and could be used to crack down on dissent.
Those two laws restrict freedom, and they restrict freedoms first because they provide overbroad definitions of terrorism acts, but also because they include provisions which could be used to crack down on dissent, such as criminalizing insults, broadcasting materials which are contrary to public morals.
Francis Patuel, a West Africa researcher for Amnesty International. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Vote counting continues in Ghana after polls to choose the country's next president and parliament. VOA's Peter Cloti, reporting from Ghana's capital of Accra, says that voting, which had been postponed in one western Ghanaian district of Jama North, ended Thursday evening, and the Electoral Commission is expected to release results soon. Earlier this morning, I reached Peter Cloti in Accra, Ghana.
Well, the general atmosphere has been calm, but that of expectation, because traditionally the Electoral Commission will release certified results of elections within 72 hours when elections are completed or concluded. However, this time around, there was a problem with one of the polling stations in the Jama North District of the country. So the Electoral Commission decided to hold off to allow those people to vote the next day. And no. That is what happened. So they can only declare results, certify results of the elections once those people who voted today were allowed to vote. So From tomorrow, the Electoral Commission promised to release certified results because they didn't want to influence the voting pattern of those people who were allowed to vote today. The Electoral Commission chairperson also said that it appears that its electronic system has been compromised, so they decided to go manual, and that is part of the reasons why things have delayed, coupled with the postponement of the election in Jama North District.
So, Peter, the Electoral Commission held a press conference today. Did they say anything about what happened at that polling station, why the process did not go as had been planned, and what are some of the other things that they said during that press conference?
Jackson, they were talking about the fact that there was a security threat. The security threat was basically counter-accusation and accusation from opposition party and the ruling party. And they held a very long meeting that held up the voting in that district. Mm. The Electoral Commission decided to postpone the election till today because of the fact that they held a very long meeting to resolve this. Now, today's press conference was basically to reassure Ghanaians that they want to get it right rather than rush to declare any result at all. And they have received almost almost 90% of all results from all the regions. However, parliamentary election results have been declared at the parliamentary level or constituency level. For the presidential election, it is only the chairperson of the Electoral Commission who has been mandated by the Constitution to declare who won a presidential election. So some of these things were mentioned by Madame Charlotte Osei, who is the chairperson of the Electoral Commission. She wanted to ensure that they are efficient and get it right rather than rush through and get it wrong.
The ruling party also held a press conference. What were they trying to communicate in their press conference?
Well, theirs were preceded. Their press conference was preceded by two press conferences held by the New Patriotic Party, the main opposition. At the crack of dawn, the New Patriotic Party held a press conference alleging that the Electoral Commission was holding, announcing the result because they want to manipulate it in favor of the National Democratic Congress, the ruling party. A few hours later, they held a press conference again to call on the EC to release the result immediately. Then the Electoral Commission held, the NDC held a press conference to call on the opposition party to tone it down because there was an agreement that they were not going to say anything to allow the Electoral Commission a free hand to operate. And then later on, if they have a problem, they can go back to resolve those problems through the proper channel. So they were saying that reports that the NPP supporters were going to march towards the offices of the Electoral Commission was wrong and that it was unacceptable. And they claimed, the ruling party that is, that their internal polling shows that President Dramani Mahama will remain the president. So these were the competing narratives as of today.
So is the opposition party saying that by withholding, by the Electoral Commission withholding the results, that works in favor or to the advantage of the ruling party?
Because they thought the DC officials will massage some of the figures or tamper with some of the figures that came from the polling stations across the country to give the ruling party the advantage to win more votes. Now, one of the reasons why they're saying that was because the NPP, out of the 275-member parliament, has won at least 171 at the last time I checked. So they won more than half. And that means they are going to become the majority in the House of in parliament. So these were some of the reasons why they were saying because the NDC appears to be losing badly, the chairperson of the Electoral Commission is withholding the results to massage it or try to fix it, so to speak, to allow President John Dramani Mahama to continue. But she flatly denies those accusations. And the NDC also denies accusations that the Electoral Commission is going to rig the vote on their behalf.
Did the local media houses or any institutions that are following these elections closely or monitoring the elections give an indication of who might have an upper hand or an advantage in these elections?
Yes, all the radio stations and TV stations are giving provisional results. However, it's only the Electoral Commission that is mandated by the Constitution to declare a presidential election.
VOA's Peter Cloti is in Accra, Ghana, where he will continue to update us on the election results. Human rights activists are concerned that Senegal's newly approved penal code defines terrorism too broadly and could be used to crack down on dissent. Amnesty International West Africa researcher Francois Patuel talks to Ricky Shryok about how the new law could crack down on freedom of expression and how it has already affected some 30 detainees accused of terrorism in Senegal.
Those two laws restrict freedom, and they restrict freedoms first because they provide overbroad definitions of terrorism acts, but also because they include provisions which could be used to crack down on dissent, such as criminalizing insults, broadcasting materials which are contrary to public morals. They also undermine the right to fair trial.
It could leave people accused of terrorism up to 12 days without seeing a judge. Pre-trial detention is already a significant human rights problem in Senegal. Could this make it worse?
Yes, I mean, already the pretrial detentions in Senegal are problematic because a prosecutor can decide to prolong your pretrial detention. And the problem with this new law on anti-terrorism is that if you are, you know, involved or if you're suspected of being involved in a terrorist act, then the prosecutor can extend your pretrial to detention to up to 12 days. That's a very long time, bearing in mind also that the law doesn't provide explicitly that you should get access to a lawyer as soon as you're deprived of your liberty. There are about 30 people who are currently in detention on terrorism-related offenses, and one of them, for instance, had to wait 11 days before being brought in front of a judge, and his lawyers could not access him for the first 4 days of his detention. So he was interrogated without his lawyers being in prison.
Senegal is very known for peaceful protests. Is this a concern that they will use this law to crack down on peaceful protests?
One of the issues with the law that revises the criminal code is that it provides a very broad definition of terrorism. One of the acts which could be categorized as a terrorist act are participating in a protest where there is violence and where a degradation of public or private property. And this is an issue because under the Senegalese law, you don't have yourself to be involved in that violence. The fact that you're participating into a gathering where that violence is occurring is sufficient to charge you under that law. And that could mean that you could be charged with a terrorist act, given that participating in such gathering could amount to terrorism in some circumstances. So that's a very big concern, is that the definition is so broad that it could be applied basically to crack down on dissent and to crack down on public liberties, including the right to peaceful assembly.
What about those who would say, look, there was an attack in Mali, there was an attack in Burkina, there was an attack in Ivory Coast. The threat of terrorism is very real in Senegal.
Yes, there's been a number of attacks by armed groups across the region, and Senegal has a duty to protect population. On the other hand, it shouldn't be using laws which crack down on liberties in general in order to fight terrorism. It should protect the rights of others, and protecting human rights and defending human rights is actually paramount in order to counter terrorism. You can't counter terrorism without justice and without human rights.
That was Francis Patuel, a West Africa researcher for Amnesty International. He was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Lomé, Togo. The World Bank and other development institutions say that money transfers by African migrants in form of remittances to their region or country of origin has been growing exponentially. The money plays a critical role in the economic development of countries like Uganda, which says that its citizens living abroad send home at least $1 billion a year. The money funds multi-million dollar investment ventures such as hospitals while helping in creating employment for people in the country. From Uganda's capital, Kampala, reporter Davis Mugumerwa Karinji has this report.
According to the World Bank, Uganda had an increase in remittances with 21% growth, receiving over $1.1 billion, or 3.6 trillion Uganda shillings. The executive director of Uganda Investment Authority, Lawrence Biensi, says that Ugandans play a critical role in improving the economy of the country.
The latest data that is available is that these people remit, what you call remittances, to Uganda have now climbed to $1 billion, which is quite a significant contribution.
Uganda Investment Authority is a government agency responsible for promoting investment. BNC says his agency will organize a summit called the Home is the Best Diaspora Summit 2016 before the end of this year between Ugandans who stay abroad and different government bodies to streamline challenges affecting Ugandans who stay abroad.
We've a private hospital in Guru called the Guru Independent Hospital. We have one here in Kampala, a Paragon Hospital. We have another one, you know, which will be commissioned very shortly in a few months in our industrial park in Weyogerere.
Ronnie Mayanja, who lives in the United Kingdom, is the coordinator of Ugandans in diaspora. He says Ugandans living overseas face various challenges.
There is a current dual citizenship law, basically, in its current state, means that if a Ugandan diaspora person has a kid, that kid does not become a Ugandan citizen until they are 18 years old. Some people want a change in that. Other people want to get their national IDs. Right now, the law in its current form does not allow us to get national IDs from abroad because the government has not sort of gazetted that whole arrangement.
Mayanja, who is on the organizing committee for the summit, also says Ugandans living abroad should be granted the opportunity to vote from abroad. BNC agrees.
Certainly, if these people are by law are recognized that they are Ugandans, they should be given the opportunity to also access these IDs, okay, so that they are like any other Ugandans. Yes, we know they live outside the country, but they still hold our Ugandan passports, and the constitution has allowed them to be to recognize the dual citizenship. And so if it is a facility that is extended to other Ugandans living here, it should equally be extended to those who live abroad.
But he says such challenges will be discussed with relevant government departments when they meet this December. He says his office is working to bring many Ugandans to invest back home. Reporting for Daybreak Africa, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj, in Kampala, Uganda.
The United States Institute of Peace and the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington sponsored a panel discussion on South Sudan. The focus was on how to prevent the further deterioration of the country's humanitarian, political, and economic crisis in the wake of the collapse of last year's peace deal. Justin Lynch was one of the speakers. He's the Associated Press journalist who was deported by the South Sudanese security agents earlier this week after covering the conflict there for the Associated Press since July. It was his first public appearance since that deportation. Lynch talked to the audience through Skype.
It's not only Yei that is at risk of further violence, it's also happening in Unity State. I was scheduled to go to Lair tomorrow, we've seen most of the civilians flee that area as well, and they're talking about the same things that we saw that I saw in Yei.
Another speaker was Cameron Hudson, the director of the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. He cautioned observers on the scenarios that could trigger genocide in the country. He says that one is the vacuum that has been created here in Washington with the end of U.S. President Barack Obama's term in office, as well as the impending departure of the U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon from the U.N. in the coming months.
If the signal is that the international community is not here, if the signal is the international community is not paying attention, it's preoccupied with other places and other things, then I think that will be interpreted. I hope not, but I think there's a risk that it could be interpreted as a green light.
John Prendergast says that U.S. policy in South Sudan has not worked. He is the founding director of the Washington-based Enough Project. He argued President Obama to send in a high-level bipartisan diplomat who could, quote-unquote, shake up things in Juba.
He's got to shake it up and send someone new. Now, when President Clinton saw the Ethiopia-Eritrea war break out, he sent his former national security advisor, Tony Lake. That's the kind of level that we need to see there and to deploy to the region till the end of his administration. Someone with bipartisan credibility would retain the possibility of staying on into the new administration.
The moderator of the discussion was former U.S. Sudan and South Sudan envoy Princeton Lyman. Scientists have discovered genetic evidence of smallpox from the remains of a 17th century mummy found in a crypt beneath a Lithuanian church. The early DNA provides a timeline of the highly infectious disease that was finally eradicated in the 20th century. Jessica Bauman has this report.
The smallpox DNA was taken from the mummified remains of the lower half of a child discovered in a crypt in Lithuania. Samples of the mummy's skin were taken by Canadian and Australian researchers, who were then able to reconstruct the decomposing genome of the virus. The mummified child, one of several bodies found in the 400-year-old crypt, provides the first conclusive evidence of smallpox in humans. Before the discovery, it was thought that the ancient Egyptian pharaoh Ramses V was the earliest example of a smallpox victim because of what scientists assumed were pox marks found on the remains. But it's so far been impossible to get DNA from 3,000 to 4,000-year-old mummies to confirm that. The child's body had no such scarring, so the discovery surprised Hendrik Poynar, director of the Ancient DNA Center at McMaster University in Ontario.
We were using these mummies as a good test to looking back in time for the potential of sort of deep time travel with viruses. So we tried to pull out all viruses, and we looked in the reeds that we found, and lo and behold, there was variola, some reeds of variola, and we thought, no, that can't be.
Widespread vaccination eliminated smallpox or variola virus as a human scourge in 1977. By reconstructing the 17th century DNA and comparing it to genomes dating to the mid-1900s and genetic material before variola's eradication in the 1970s, the scientists concluded the sample shared a common viral ancestor that originated between 1588 and 1645. In addition to providing a timeline of smallpox, scientists believe they've pinpointed a clear point in its evolution. They think two strains branched off from a common ancestor around the time that a variola vaccine was created in the 1800s by Edward Jenner. Scientists believe the vaccine caused pressure on the smallpox virus, leading to mutations that separated the virus into two strains, variola major and variola minor. One strain caused a more severe form of the disease than the other. The time period when the strains branched off, according to Poynard, coincides in history with human exploration, migration, and colonization, activities that would have caused smallpox to spread around the world. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Thursday said the Syrian government has stopped all active military operations in Aleppo, and a meeting has been scheduled between U.S. and Russian military experts to discuss the situation moving forward. It's now time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning, Samson.
Good morning, Jackson. We begin with the ban on three African football officials by World Football Governing Body, FIFA. Those affected include former president of the South African FA at the time of the 2010 World Cup, Christian Namantandani, who was found guilty of fixing four South African friendlies prior to the World Cup on home soil. He has been banned by FIFA for 5 years for that offense, which also include his failure to report suspected corruption and for being uncooperative during the investigation. Former Zimbabwean FA official Jonathan Musavangena and ex-Togo coach Banatinkali both received life bans for bribery and corruption relating to the international friendlies in South Africa. To Nigeria, where the country's Minister of Sports, Solomon Dalong, has accused the Nigerian Football Federation of complicity in the way the Nigerian FA handled the non-payment of allowances and bonuses due to the Super Falcons of Nigeria, who just won the recently concluded African Women Cup of Nations title in Cameroon. The minister said though the victory of the girls in Cameroon was unexpected, the protest that followed the non-payment of the allowances was, to say the least, ugly. To Kenya now, where Olympic marathon champion Eliud Kipchoge and 5,000 meters gold medalist Vivian Cheruiyot have been named Kenya's best athletes for 2016. The two are among athletes who were recognized and awarded at the annual Athletics Kenya Awards held at the Nairobi Hotel on Wednesday night. And now to the Egyptian League, where Saad Samir scored in stoppage time as Al Ahly capitalized on a slip-up by arch-rival Zamalek to defeat resilient Samoa 1-0 for their seventh straight Egyptian Premier League win on Thursday. It was Al Ahly's first home win over Samoa in the league since 2012, helping the leaders move 10 points clear of second place Makasa, who have two matches in hand. In basketball news, a day after suffering a heartbreaking defeat in Group B, Recreativo de Lisboa Bolu bounced back in style, edging out Algerian champions GS Petroliers 93-84 in the Federation of International Basketball Association African Champions Cup. Making their FIBA African Champions Cup ACC 2016 debut, former continental champions Primeiro de Agosto needed to step up against Nzuyo Manto of Cameroon to avoid what seemed to become the biggest upset in Thursday's action, beating the Cameroonians 86-78. And finally, in boxing news, Nigerian-born British boxer Anthony Joshua has vowed to make Eric Molina look like a novice when he defends his IBF heavyweight title in Manchester tomorrow. The IBF champion sparked an angry reply from Molina when he promised to outclass his challenger in Saturday's world title fight, despite the fact that Joshua is a big puncher. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that's it for this Friday, the 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all in Africa a good weekend.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC GMT right here on VOA Africa.